Joseph Norris of Youngstown State University Oral History Department at the Caffera Building on Belmont Avenue, Youngstown, Ohio, on Tuesday, November 14th, 1978, at 12 p.m. Okay, Mr. Norris, I thought we'd start with a very brief personal biography of you, the descendants of these wonderful Lebanese people. Tell me a little bit about yourself. Where were you born? What do you do? Where were you educated?
Well, I was born on the east side of Winston. Mm-hmm. My grandmother was born in the city of Belmont. And I was born on the street in
Oh, really?
My parents were pronounced with an Arabic. My dad's name was Ariza, but that there's no real English translation. We always call them R-I-Z-E-K, Rizek. Fairly close. And his middle name was Simon, which is his father's name. And the last name that he used in this country was Nora, which is his grandfather's name.
His grandfather's first name?
Right. Okay. And the family name is really what my dad's first name is, Rizek. Within the family of Rizek, and the heritage or the roots go back to Lebanon, to a village called Tula, T-O-U-L-A, which is in the region of Batum, in northern Lebanon. My father was born, though, in the United States. He was born here in January of 1901, and at the present moment I can't recall the date. I think it may have been January the 27th, 1901. My mother was born in 1910, April the 20th. My mother was born in Canada, but I'll tell you more about her later. I'll tell you first about my dad. He was born here, as I said, in 1901, and at the time he was baptized in St. Columbus, but it wasn't a cathedral, the grandson wasn't a diocesan cathedral, it was just a Catholic church. He was baptized there because there was no Maronite church, no Maronite Catholic church. My dad was here until he was one and a half years old. At the age of one and a half, his parents took him back to Lebanon, where he remained until he was about almost 27 years old. He came back to his country in 1927. I'm not sure when, but it was in the latter part of 1927 he came to his country. So it was just before he turned 27 years old. But he spent his whole boyhood and his teen years and his young adulthood in Lebanon. And in some ways, he had very fond memories of that, but in many ways, he felt that it handicapped him as far as having had an opportunity to succeed in the country. My father, when he came here, came like an immigrant. He could not read or write or speak English. And he used to regret that. He would say, I was born in this country, and I was deprived of the opportunity to learn the language. I can't read, I can't write, I can't speak English. And he could never read or write English, except he found his language. He spoke naturally fluent Arabic, and he read Arabic, and wrote Arabic. He used to have an Arabic newspaper coming to the house on his daily, and I'm sure I think it was published 4 or 5 times a week. The newspaper that would come, and he was the only thing he could read. He could not read English. And he worked at the first job that he ever got. It was the only job that he had in the country. He kept all of the time he was here. It was a trust fund school division of the public school corporation. He first went to work at trust fund, and it was just the trust fund steel company, it wasn't owned by the public. And my mother was pregnant and was due to have a baby, like almost any day, and didn't have a son, never had a son in this country. So he went there to Trust Fund, and they sent him to the supervisor, man by the name of Mr. Williams. I can remember that my dad used to always talk about Mr. Williams, and that Mr. Williams gave him a job and gave him a chance. My dad was afraid for Mr. Williams because of it. My dad begged him on his hands and knees to give him a job, and his wife was about to have a baby. So they put him to work. He worked for 7 months still.
What year was that?
That was from, let's see, go back up a little bit. My dad and mom got married in 1933. Grandfather died in the meantime, my dad's father. In fact, he died when he was 27 years old, my dad's father. And that was over in Lebanon. He had great bad temper, and he became angry. And the door was locked, and he didn't want to be locked. And he kicked his foot through the door, and gangrene set in, and the guy was bloodless. There was nothing, you know, if somebody didn't work in a family, it was all right, as long as somebody worked, those that worked for the whole family. There was, you know, never any problems like that. You know, so people like that, they really did take care of each other, take care of their own.
When your father came over, didn't come with his mother and his brother?
No, his mother and brother were there. His mother and brother lived there and came here for a couple of years. My dad followed him for 17 years in 1927. His father, he came here, and he met my mother here. So my father was really, you know, born in this country, born in the United States. So he was born in child of immigrant parents, but he was raised in Lebanon. My mother was also a child of immigrant parents. Her parents came to this country, and I'm not sure when they came, but when they first came here, they came to Youngstown. But my grandfather could not find employment. So he went up to Canada. He had a chance in Canada. He couldn't mind Nova Scotia, Canada, get a candy store. So he went to work for a confectionery store in Boston. And he went to work for her in a confectionery store. And my mother was born in Sydney, Miles, Nova Scotia, Canada. And then they came to this country. And I don't know when Mom and my parents came to this country. I know that she was a little girl. She wasn't more than 4 or 5 years old, maybe. So really, I would say they came in the mid 1910, 1915, somewhere around there, that they came back to Youngstown. And Mom, because of the fact that she was not born in this country, and her parents hadn't been born in this country, had to be a naturalized citizen. And Dad was a born citizen, so he would speak them because Mom spoke fluent English, and he was educated here in the United States. So with Mom, it was, she could handle the English language. It was her language. That was her native tongue. So, and Dad's native tongue was Arabic. So he succeeded. It was reversed. The role was reversed. He was born in the United States and she was born out of the United States. But the language didn't teach us that.
Didn't seem quite fair, huh?
No, he succeeded. She didn't know the fact that Dad was born in the United States, Mom was naturalized. She wasn't born in the United States.
And yet he had the problem.
She was a little foreigner. He wasn't. So we used to kick him a lot about that. They met when he came.
The second time? Obviously, the second time. Yeah, obviously.
This time he came.
Great question.
Second time he came here, he was 1927. He got here 2 months ago. Of course, he was a young girl. They used to say, start seeing each other. Of course, when the parental died in supervision. I would say probably, the beginning of the 30s, maybe 1933. My dad was known as a gay play. I would say, he had quite a few girlfriends when he got here. He was very handsome. He was expected he would, get married. There were several that, I guess that he was going to marry and changed his mind. I think what got it, finally he married my mother. And before she married my dad, she was her maiden name was Gayla. Mary Gayla. As I said earlier, when I married in 1933, I don't remember when, neither one of them is alive, they're both deceased.
When did they pass away?
My dad died, first of all, in 1959, my dad suffered a massive cerebral hemorrhage at the end of 1959. It's in December the 7th, and he was in a coma for 35 days, and during the time that he was in a coma, the prognosis of the doctor was very bad. Could not stay in bed, never anticipated that he would survive. He said he would never wake up from the coma. have a couple of years where he was reasonably lucid, and although he was paralyzed on his left side, but he had a couple of good years, maybe a couple of good years, but then he started to slip, and died in 1969 in June. We kept him at home all the time, but in his last few years, we took care of him like a little baby. And he wasn't able to communicate very well, and he couldn't talk during the last couple of years. And died in June of 69, and then Mom died in 1973, in October. I had always made my home with them. To begin with, I made my home with them. We lived on North Plain Avenue, which is St. Cleo's born on, except we lived up the street from my grandparents. We lived at 24 North Plain. Until I was, I was born in 1935. And in 1959, in fact, a month before my dad became ill, and we were on the north side of Johnson. Laura Avenue. Mm-hmm. So I was about 24 years old then. And I bought the house on Laura Avenue. And in fact, we had living with us at the time. We just moved to Laura Avenue. I didn't have just me the uncle that I mentioned. My dad's brother would have taken care of my dad. They made their home together too. Mm-hmm. And even after my dad was married, he continued to live with his mother and brother.
So you were born in your grandmother's house?
My paternal grandmother's house. Down the street. But I was raised in my paternal grandmother's house. It was still home with my uncle. My dad and mom lived with him. And then my paternal grandmother died probably when I was 21 years, 7 or 8 years old. We stayed there, we lived there in that house. My uncle's house, my dad's brother. He was the only brother that my dad had, except that they had several brothers and sisters in between them that all died at a very young age. They died from, new epidemic that wiped out a couple of them. I think there were four children who came out. He was the oldest one, but I mean, my dad was the youngest. And the last four of those died as children, very young children.
Probably didn't hear too much about them. It was difficult.
No, because my dad didn't know that. My dad, he was younger. And they all died at very young ages. So my dad didn't even know that they existed. We moved, as I said, in 1959 to the north side of Johnstown, Florida Avenue. And a month after we moved, my dad had a few of them. But I bought the house in Florida, and I lived with my parents and my uncle with me, plus my sister, who were all family. I wasn't married at the time. I met my wife, in fact, through my dad's roommate. My dad was in New York, he was seriously really bad on private duty nurses. My wife happened to be one of the private duty nurses.
What kind of?
Betty. Maiden name? Barna. She's from Boardman. She was raised in South Carolina, and then she doing private duty camping here. She wanted to bring real intensity because she'd been trained for 2 years in camping and to take care of people who were, you know, like terminally ill with cancer. But I guess we were pretty persuasive that she had it. She had a cancer patient just before my dad. And so we were pretty persuasive in getting her to meet my dad's case. We knew about her.
Mm-hmm.
We were told about this great nurse doing private duty and some friends who had gotten there. So we persuaded her to come on my dad's case, and that's how I got to meet her.
Mm-hmm.
Then after my dad's cancer, you know, stayed in the hospital for like about 120 days. We brought him home, threw our home and blew right out of me. And then we kept him for 10 years.
You've got children. They
Why
were.
Oh,
okay. That's a lot of children.
Yeah.
By today's standards. Did your children then knew your father?
My first child was born in 62, March of 1962. She was 7 years old when her mom started dying.
So they're very small.
Yeah, now she remembers them, but like, I don't think she remembers them clearly. Of course she might, I don't know. She was 7 years old, and then the one behind her was about a year and a half younger than her, so she was she was almost 6 years old when she died, the second time.
Mm-hmm.
She may remember a little bit of it. And that turned on the others. I don't think they remember.
Probably not. The older two, I think, probably would have.
Yeah.
Some recollection.
Most of my children have vivid memories of their grandmother, she was very close to them before she died.
Mm-hmm.
And, they used to call it Zyza. You know, it's spelled out Zyza. Z-I-C-H-A. Zyza.
Okay.
And it's sort of, it's just like a nickname for grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
The word in Arabic for grandmother is Tristy. But, you know, Zyza is like calling her Nanny or something like that.
Well, like in Slovak, it would be Baba.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. So my children still talk about Zyza.
Mm-hmm.
They remember her. She died, all my children were born when she died. In fact, my baby, Elizabeth, was about 10 months old. My mother died in October. Elizabeth turned 1 year old in December of 1973. You know, I don't think Elizabeth remembers it, but the other kids still do. They remember Zyza. Died at home, so there was a couple of younger ones that were at home. See, they weren't in school. You know, they weren't in school yet. And the day she died, the older ones, but the younger ones that were home with her were there when she died in the class, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They were there. And so it was sort of an exciting experience.
Yeah.
But, so I think they still remember that.
Why do you think your grandfather originally came to this area. Why do you think Lebanese people came to Youngstown?
I think opportunity. My grandfather came to Youngstown originally to seek opportunity. Things weren't good about them. They only lived from what they were able to grow themselves. There's a lot of poverty and starvation. Lebanon was never an industrialized country. There wasn't work. They would go to some of the more heavily populated areas to do some work, do arguments, jobs for yourself and sell vegetables, sell things they do in the garden. But that was about it. I mean, most of, they ate what they were able to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And, at the beginning of the 20th century, the United States, America was the land of opportunity. And so they came seeking, opportunity. The main reason that my grandfather came to Youngstown, rather than the Phoenix area or somewhere else, was that there was a man who had come to Youngstown. Why he came, I don't know. But he had come from my dad's village, my grandfather's village. He was a man by the name of Mr. Yazbek, Lahoud Yazbek, L-A-H-O-U-D. That was his first name. His last name was Yazbek, Y-A-G-E-K. Now he had come to Youngstown, and he was successful. I think he was a dry goods business, selling, dry goods.
Mm-hmm.
He was a rather successful man, and became a very influential man, a very well-liked man among local business people and politicians. But he was a very, became like an instantly influential person. Was able to, help people get jobs, find ways of making money, of earning a livelihood, and so that it was because that man was here, and that man had established himself, naturally he broke, to his friends and his relatives in Lebanon, that there were opportunities, there were jobs here, and so they came.
Mm-hmm.
That's why my grandfather came to Youngstown in particular, because of the fact that Mr. Yazbek was in fact related to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he helped him with an opportunity here. Well, when my grandfather came here, as I said, my dad was born here in 1901. And I'm not sure the year that my grandfather came, although I know that it wasn't. It had to be late 1890 or 1900 or something, because my uncle Richard, the one that I referred to earlier, was living, was born in 1895 in Lebanon, and they left him there, his relatives. They didn't bring him. They didn't bring any of their children, because they wanted to get themselves started here, and then they would bring their children over, they would send them here.
Okay.
And when my grandfather found that he wasn't happy here, and he returned, he came to Lebanon. And then, my dad with him, my dad was 1.5 years old. My grandfather was never returned. So he never died in Lebanon, a soldier. Had it been not too long after he returned to Lebanon, he was just supposed to adore what that love says to him. Then it wasn't long after that, after his death, that my grandmother came back again to try again.
Mm-hmm.
And this time she brought my Uncle Richard with her, who had been born in 1895. And I think they came probably about 1910. And, my Uncle Richard was about 15 years old when he came to this country. And my dad was left behind, and he was maybe 9 years old, and he was left behind. And she left him there, and her sister. My grandmother's sister raised my dad because he always talked about his aunt, you know, he loved his aunt very much. The one that raised him. So my dad never came back and joined his mother again until his sister in 1927. So he was about 17 years away from his mother. His mother was 17 years away from him. And I left him to be raised by his sister. So she was a widow. She was young.
The sister or your mother?
My grandmother was. She lost her husband. She, you know, was very able to raise her children. I just know to hear that, you know, there's something going with the children here.
For more opportunity, they'd have better lives. Do you think there was a very large Lebanese community here about the time of your father came? Were there people living near each other?
Yeah, there were. There were quite a few. I can't tell you how many families. But there were a lot of families, and they lived, most of them lived in the downtown area around East Federal Street before they had a church. And they lived in buildings, and there was nothing for, you know, two or three families to live together.
And most of them probably rented homes, or they wouldn't be able to buy them right away,
right? No, they rented apartment rooms, you know, two rooms, three rooms, whatever they could find available. Mm-hmm. And they would live, you know, three families together. You know, and, they didn't have their own home. As they got jobs and they started to, you know, be able to save a little bit of money and just gather money together and be able to buy homes, they would buy homes in close vicinity to the church. First church, you know, the first Maronite church we had. It was a permanent church. I understand there was a temporary church somewhere, but I don't know where it was. They had a church that used temporarily, but our first permanent church was on Wilson Avenue, which is on the east side. The building still exists. So once the church became established, many of the Lebanese families tried to buy homes as close as they could to the church, because this was part of their culture. Their lives centered around the church. The main part of their lives was the church.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way that, I've never been to Lebanon, but this is the way the villages of Lebanon are described in the outset. The villages, the focal point of the villages is the church. I've seen this in many pictures of villages in Lebanon. You see a picture of a village in the mountains, the thing that stands out is the church. And then the homes were just in circle of the church, and this would make up the village. The church was a means of communicating in Lebanon. For instance, if there was a birth, they rang the bells a certain way, and if there was a death, they rang the bells a certain way, or a wedding, they rang a certain way. With the bells of the church, they would pass messages from village to village. So that, you know, whatever was happening, you know, when one village had something to announce, it would ring its bell, and a certain way it rang its bell, the code. And the next village would pick it up, and it would ring its bell, and it would pass the message through the mountains, the weathering, by ringing its bell. So that was a very sort of a primitive way of communicating news, but that's how they did it. So the church plays an important role in their lives. And it was the one place where they all gathered together.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what it was, you know, joy or sorrow or what, the church was
part
of their lives.
Even in this country, I imagine it was a lot handier for them, it being the center part of their lives. Probably many of them didn't have cars or transportation.
They bought homes close to each other so that they could get to the church without transportation.
Mm-hmm.
They could just walk to the church.
Yeah. So some of the people I talked to mentioned that even now they go to daily mass. I imagine it might have been even more frequent then.
My dad used to go to daily mass and he said something was in the
mm-hmm.
And he could take me with him and he was there. So I like it one kind of situation, you know. And because it's been, you know, like I've had direct contact with that generation.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, it had the church as the most important part of their lives. Now here, you know, if you take my generation, the church is an important part of my life, but I also have many other parts of my life too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, besides, you know, my family, I mean, I have professional organizations that I'm involved with. There are other activities besides the church. The generation before me, my parents, my grandparents, the church was everything. It was the religious life, it was the social life, it was everything.
Mm-hmm.
It was their means of being in contact with their parents and all of everything. The church was the most important part of their lives, you know, other than their immediate family. But they were so close. I mean, their immediate families and the church, I mean, this was all synonymous.
Yeah.
You know, the church was their family, you know, and so I'm like, my connection is with that generation. So the church has an important part, because they're an important part to me,
mm-hmm.
and to my generation.
I understand you're a deacon, or?
I'm an ordained sub-deacon in the church. I'm not an ordained sub-deacon in our church. I am supposed to be completing my study to become a permanent deacon, but I haven't been doing much of that. It's just the obligations of family and work and other things that still have kept me kind of away from it. But I am ordained, and I do it just on the altar of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And the student community. And just that it's good.
Mm-hmm.
And if I take my studies to become a permanent deacon, why I would be able to do more things, I'd be able to baptize, I'd be able to marry.
Oh, really?
Become a marriage ceremony.
Is this the move to the Maronite rite?
Oh, my. In fact, the Roman rite of the Western Church, we're Catholic. We're under the Pope, so. Western Church, I mean of recent times, the Western Church has gone to permanent deacon. But, you know, the Diocese of Youngstown has quite a few lay deacons, married deacons.
Were there any non-Christian Lebanese in Syria, do you know?
Oh, yes.
Did they associate at all, or with the Christian Lebanese?
No. I still, to this day, meet people who are Lebanese, who I never met. I mean, who are in the community,
mm-hmm.
families have been in the community for a long time, since the early 1900s, but that I didn't know. They were Lebanese Orthodox, Lebanese Catholic. No, that was one thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was the faith that was the most important part. It was, you know, it wasn't all the Lebanese that stay together.
Okay.
It depended. If you're a Lebanese Catholic, you stayed with the Lebanese Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
The other Lebanese people of other faiths, they weren't quite as close as the Lebanese Christians. The Lebanese Maronite community had its own church.
Mm-hmm.
And the others weren't enough for them to have their own church. So what they did is they became part of the other Orthodox Lebanese. Next to the Maronite Christians, Maronite Catholics, were the Orthodox. And so they aligned themselves with the Orthodox community in the area. Gospels, most of them became part of like the Greek Orthodox. You want to say something about the text? Big bags to put on Lebanese food, to sell Lebanese food. And they're a very small part of the Lebanese community in that town. There are some Lebanese Catholics, Lebanese Christians, but for some reason, when they got to this country, they're not become part of the, they stick with the community.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, I don't know. Maybe they wanted to break away from that. Maybe they want to break away from their people and take on the culture of this country rather than continue with the culture of the old country. But I still run into, right up to this day, a lot of people who are Lebanese, or, who were born with Lebanese parents, and just talking, who are your parents, or your grandparents. See, I never heard that name before, You're Catholic. Yeah, you're Catholic, Well, did your family go to St. Mary's? No, my grandfather never took us to St. Mary's. That just made a surprise. Their grandfather, maybe came over from Lebanon, and that really didn't then continue to associate with the other Lebanese people that were there. So they wanted to find their own way. For whatever reason.
Do you think there was any discrimination against, say, Lebanese or Middle Eastern people, or I know some of the European Catholics felt some discrimination. Do you think that maybe that may have played a role?
That may be the answer to that. Of course there's discrimination. There's always discrimination against people who are considered foreign or immigrant. I mean, that was a label. I don't care whether it was Italian or Irish or what, if you consider a foreigner or an immigrant, there was discrimination between people who felt that they were, blue bloods, in the United States, because this is their country and they were true Americans. And then the saying that wasn't a true American discrimination.
Mm-hmm. If there was anything? Of course, this is probably just a little bit before your father coming here. But say the Klan gave some of the East European Catholics a father, in the late 20s, in Youngstown. And if there was anything like that with the Mennonites.
No, I never heard that. That
may have been later than that your family. What about celebrations of the church? I was told yesterday that a Lebanese wedding would go on for a whole week in Lebanon. Did they carry that type of thing through here?
My mother and father had a 4-day wedding. 4 days. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
At some party.
4 days. In fact, I think my sister, my older sister, Rose, and her husband had the last 2-day wedding. Now, I can remember very vividly 2-day weddings.
Mm-hmm.
And the 2-day weddings would be that the couple would be married on Saturday, usually at 10 o'clock in the morning on Saturday. And then following the ceremony in the church, and that usually lasted about an hour, 45 minutes. It was a very high ritual
Lebanese food.
And, you know, that's the breakfast. But then they would begin the partying and the drinking, and then later in the evening, they would have a big dinner, a big time dinner. And the people did their own cooking. Mother would spend the whole 2 days in the kitchen and just take off, you know, cooking. You know, she married and participated in some wedding celebration. She take a cooking, her relatives, making the native food. They would have the big bridal dinner in the evening for all of the guests. There was no such thing in those days as spending that wedding. A week before, the priest invited the parish.
Mm-hmm.
He invited everybody in the community on behalf of the bride and the groom and their parents to come to the wedding and to the wedding ceremony and celebration. And it was an open invitation to everybody. So everybody came and they brought their kids and all because, you know, when it was a wedding, we didn't have to cook for the weekend. You went on Saturday to the church and you had a big breakfast or brunch after Mass, after the wedding Mass, and in the evening you had a big dinner. And then the next day, at the main liturgy, the Sunday liturgy, while the bride and the groom would come to church and they would sit up in the first row and the family would sit behind them. And then it was around after that Sunday liturgy, which really had nothing to do with the title of the church.
Yeah.
It was sort of somehow, some way, would still have a little connection. Then they would have another big dinner after the Sunday liturgy.
Mm-hmm.
Wedding celebration, and they taper off, you know, wedding cake and things like that, and cookies and desserts. But I can remember very vividly the 2 day wedding.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember, I can't remember the 3 and 4 day celebration. My mom and dad did a 4 day celebration.
Mm-hmm.
It started on Thursday and it went through Sunday. One big party.
This had to be a big expense for the
family.
Well,
it's just that they did most of it, you know.
Yeah.
And they were having labor,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, like you would have said, theater.
Right.
You know, the cost of the food, the cost of the liquor, and everything else. Yeah, that was a, even that was a pretty big expense.
When you had the whole parish coming, you know,
yeah.
With all the children. And
you had the whole parish.
Yeah.
You brought all their children. Very proper. It was very much even expected.
What about, say, christening? Did they have parties for the new babies when they were christened? Or, like today, some people have the parties in my culture.
Very good. Christening is very good. They were big parties for the big children. Right in the church hall, and then the celebration after the Mass.
Mm-hmm.
And say the exact part of the celebration right in the church hall.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be almost like a little
thing. Here, was it the same for boy and girl babies? I read in Lebanon in past years, girls were not really popular.
The parties weren't quite as happy, and they weren't quite as exciting,
yeah.
Gay, and it was a deal, you know.
Yeah.
For boys, the parties were real black.
Yeah.
The boys seemed like the men got drunker, you know, and happier,
yeah.
And sang more. But it's been the good one with the girl. You know. The girls' parties were a little calmer. You know.
Mm-hmm. I was talking to Mr. Hayes yesterday. Oh no, Mr. Ohana. And one of his children are about to have a child, and I asked him, what do you want to hope for, boy or girl? He says, oh, we want a boy. You know, so that still carries through, you know, still a little bit of excitement.
Well, my grandmother, terribly upset. And so she found out that my second daughter had been named to her. And my maternal grandmother's name is Sabita, B-A-B-I-T-A. So phonetically pronounced as Sabita. Still don't say that. And so when she found out that my second daughter was named after her, with tears and her anger, she was angry. She was angry with joy that it was a kid and not a boy yet. She was so happy when she found out that my daughter was named to be there after her. So she must have just been understanding because my children, my brothers, my nephews, she named everybody that she was related to going back to the beginning of time that she could remember that it had children. Nobody ever named anyone for her until I came along and named the daughter after her. I think he's asked his said he might, and he said to his death, but I named her. Named the daughter after. In fact, that, you know, my dad, boy, my dad got had this illness in 1959. I was 23 years old then. And I wasn't much one for dating. I dated occasionally, but, you know, I wasn't dating seriously with any money, and I didn't really have it in mind that I wanted to get married. Getting married didn't seem to me. Just didn't like it to stay long as it did. My dad was kind of bad. I was going to tell her, but I kind of hurt her. I kind of liked her when we were first. She was kind of very aloof. But it wasn't too long after she came on my dad's stage that I just started taking her down to the cafeteria and coffee and things like that. And that's talking, and I think she kind of liked me. Because I met her like in about December the 14th, and between December and February, we really got to like each other. In fact, I proposed to her on Valentine's Day, February 1st, 1960. That wasn't too much after I married her. And we got married in October of 1960. But the point that I wanted to make was that I became attracted to her. And when my dad first, became very, very ill in this moment, the doctor said he was going to die. My mother, she was broken in two, even when my father would die, and I didn't know. We were very close to this end. And I went down to the, before that, a friend of mine gave me a relic of St. Jude, and he told me, take that relic in my dad's room, and put the relic in my dad's room, and to make a promise to St. Jude, to promise St. Jude something, and that my dad would be all right, he wouldn't die. So, of course, then, you know, that was back in the time that a lot of talk about Danny Thomas. Danny Thomas was going to go to the hospital, St. Jude's Hospital. They answered Danny Thomas's prayer, you know, the story about Danny Thomas in the hospital. And then, of course, you know, I couldn't go to any hospital for St. Jude. And I went down to the chapel and I prayed, and I prayed to St. Jude. And I said, St. Jude, I mean, I'm not Danny Thomas. I can't promise I'm going to go to any hospital to do anything like that for you. And I really don't know what I can do for you. But I know that my dad, you know, always prayed that I'd get married and that I would have a son, and that he would be able to see that son before he died. So I'll tell you what, I said the same too, that bargain with him. I said, if I ever get married, and then I had no, I bet he wasn't in my mind. If I ever get married, if I ever have a son, I'm named that son. Okay, that's my promise. And then, you know, I became attracted to Betty. Started to date Betty, proposed to her. My dad came out of coma after 35 days answering the prayer. The prayer was answered.
Mm-hmm.
So it was through my dad's illness that I met Betty. My dad wanted me to make it. It was because of my dad's illness that I made a promise that I named my first son too. Betty and I got married in October of 1960. My dad was alive. They said he stayed alive for 10 years. Almost 10 years before he died. He stayed alive in invalid. The first four children that we had were girls. Okay? My son, Jude, was born. My wife became pregnant with our fifth child. She went into labor on October 28, 1968. Okay? She went into labor. I was taking her to the hospital, and my sister Julie said to me, she said, Joe, you know you're going to have a son today. And I said, Julie, what do you mean? The whole family knew my promise.
Yeah.
St. Jude. She says, you're going to have a son because today is the feast of St. Jude. It was October 28, 1968. And sure enough, we had a boy. And he was born on the feast of St. Jude. And that's a promise that went back from 1959 to 1968. So the coincidence of having four daughters, and then they have the fifth son, and they have him born on the feast of St. Jude. So I think that it was St. Jude's way of letting me know, of giving me an acknowledgement back that my prayer had been answered. My father, in 1968, had become the point where he could not communicate with anybody. He didn't respond to questions or answers. He had really become very much like a vegetable. He was paralyzed, he had to be fed, he had to be everything held down for him. And I told you earlier that my dad said, you know, my prayer is that I could live to see your son. So when we brought you home from the hospital, my mother said, you know, I got to take, you know, Julian, I have to take him in to your father, to your father's decision. But this is what he prayed for. Your father prayed that he would see your son before he died. So we took him in, and my mother said to him, she called him by his name, Rizzo. And he opened his eyes and looked up at her. And she said, your son, this is your son's son. And his name, you know, she called him, his name is Jude. And he was, you know, she called him, he was born 5 days ago, and we just brought him home from the hospital. My dad reached up with his right arm. He's the only arm that he only his right arm and right leg to remove. And he hadn't shown emotion in years because he just had so much brain damage. And he reached up and he just took the baby gently from her with the one arm, pulled my son Jude to his chest and started to kiss him, kiss his head, and started to cry. And it was the first time in years that my dad had cried because, you know, with all the brain damage, so he didn't have the ability to show emotion. And he only lived with him for the following two. got to see my son, who was born on October 28th, 1968, my son, and he died in 1969. Mm-hmm. But my dad was a person of very deep faith. Oh, my dad was really a very religious man. Mm-hmm. And he used to pray the rosary. You familiar with the rosary? You can?
Yeah.
My dad used to pray the rosary. In fact, when he had us, we were in the 27. In 1959, he had us through the 100, and the longest training was when he was in a coma. He was in a coma for 35 days, as I said earlier. When he came out of the coma, the way he came out of the coma, the first movement that he made in his body in 35 days, was to raise his right hand and make the sign of the cross. And he really tried to raise his hand. It was really a man, really deep. When he was working, he was pretty much all his life at the restaurant, or all, you know, he was working here, and he only got to the restaurant. He had, back in the early 50s, he suffered a heart attack. And so they gave him an easier job then. They gave him the tool room. He became the tool room clerk. And, guys, men in the mills, can you imagine the kind of pictures they had in the tool rooms and things like that?
Yeah.
They were all girly pictures. So I gave my dad the girly room, the tool room. I gave my dad the tool room. He became the tool room clerk on the afternoon shift. And my dad looked at every girly picture in there, and he lined the wall with materials and photo pictures. You want to know something? There was a man in that mill that worked with them that had anything to do with what he said about it. In fact, they used to call my dad a saint, and they felt like they needed something, or that they really had a prayer for, they'd come with that to dad and pray for. That's the kind of guy he was.
You mentioned that he worked with Trust Khan. Did other people work, Lebanese people work there?
A lot of them.
Did most of them have the same types of jobs?
No. They're not like the Greeks that were all bridge painters. No. But a lot of them worked with Trust Khan. And the only reason for that was, again, there's a very simple answer to that. Trust Khan was on the east side. They lived on the east side. It was a natural thing for them to go down to the Trust Khan and apply for work because they could walk to work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Right.
It was all the transportation problem. Mm-hmm. They went to church near their home. They worked near their home. They shopped near their home. They did everything near their home.
The businesses that have grown in your neighborhood, would they mostly be operated by Lebanese people? Grocery stores and things that might have been
there. There were a couple of Lebanese grocery stores that were owned by Lebanese people. Mm-hmm. We dealt with a little grocery store that was on the corner of our street, and it was owned by a Palestinian family. So they were Arabs, but not Lebanese.
Mm-hmm. What about the women? If the women ever went out and took off, say during the Depression, it was really tough for anybody to get a job. And did they help out?
A lot of them. I went around and they sold dry goods.
Mm-hmm.
And they were hucksters. They go around with their wares, sell blind goods. They would make things. Crochet, and they would embroider, knit, and they would sell things up there.
Would they go door to door?
Mm-hmm. Knock on doors. And they'd go down and they'd buy from the wholesaler. They would buy yard goods, and they would buy bedding things, and they'd sell stuff like that. They'd go around and sell them.
Mm-hmm.
Or they'd make things, yard goods. They'd make dresses, and they'd make pillowcases, they make aprons, and go around selling stuff like that. So that's how the women help. They would just make stuff like that. But the women, in those years,
at least for some of the other nationalities, some of the women would go do housework, say, for some of the wealthier people in town. You don't think that? What about children helping out? Do the children ever have small jobs or something aside from, say, going to school? They would maybe sell things.
Not so much, except the boys, were encouraged at young ages to get themselves little jobs. I used to ride on a junk wagon, a horse and buggy. This guy had his horse and buggy, and he used to go around as a junk collector. I used to work with him and help him, you know, pick up junk, and I used to give him something like 10 or 15 cents a day to help him. Down the street from us with a nice house, I'd help down the ice house or whatever I could pick up. Boys were encouraged to do that. Girls were encouraged more to help around the house. Boys, one thing about it, boys were never, forced to work around the house. This wasn't a boy's job. Lebanese were domesticated their sons, they domesticated their daughters, trained their daughters to be wives and mothers. But I could remember my sister used to always scream and holler that they'd have to do things around the house, but I never had to do anything around the house. She doesn't have to.
She's a boy.
She's a boy. Boys don't do work around the house.
Have you carried that out with your children? Or you look really?
My sons catch back at their interests, but they're given choice to do anything.
What about education? Was this a big threat in the community? Did most of the children, say, go to a Catholic school, or did they go to public school? Or were parents very dedicated to having their children get an education?
We went to a school that was a little closer to us. Yeah, it wasn't a big, real serious question. It wasn't that close. We went to a Catholic school. I went to a Catholic school because the Catholic school was only a block away. But she went to the school that was the closest to us.
Again, centered.
East to the high school, went to Lincoln Elementary School, Lincoln Junior High, Oak Street School. For the most part, they went to public schools. But at the public schools, there were more of them and closer to them. So I went to Catholic school because we were close to them. There was a big stress then, education. Sure, they wanted, every father wanted his son to go to college. And in fact, my uncle and my father, when I was very young, opened up a savings. People's banks downtown, and they used to go and take out of every pay, each one of them would put $5 into the savings account for my education. There was never any talk of saving money for the education of my sisters, just for my education.
At that time, that was the concern.
You had to educate the boys.
Because the girls were just going to be wives and mothers anyway, right?
That's right.
What about teaching catechism? Did you go to Sunday catechism, or did you learn most of it at home?
A little bit of both. It was always taught the religion at home. It played a very important part in most of the family. But we always had Sunday catechism. We always had Sunday catechism. We got smack across the bed.
We didn't skip. Okay, what about Lebanese organizations that you remember? Do you see any continuity, say, from what you've heard about Lebanon, the early days here, and what's now?
I don't know what they had as organizations over there. but I know that there wasn't much in the way of organization because, you know, the parish was all one, was like one family, you know, there wasn't a necessity of organization. Here, I think the organization started out, you know, like there were various clubs and groups that got started here. When I was a kid, it was a very active youth group. Our youth group would get together, you know, we would roller skate and play ball together. We enjoyed being together much more than, it seems that today it's harder to get our youth together than it was in my day. In my day, we really, you know, we look forward to the, our youth gatherings being together. Of course, we didn't have all the other, you know, things like television, you know, all the other interests that could go on, like, you know, the activities in high school and all that other bit. We didn't have that much, so, you know, the thing that, we look forward to is being, you know, part of our youth group.
Do you think the kids today feel a strong attachment to the Maronite Church and to their history? I know that with Father Ashfar. I was just saying that Father Ashfar was saying that he gave classes in Arabic and French to, I assume, some of the children, and I noticed that would be a continuity when, you know, with the stress of the culture. You don't think that that's having a positive effect?
They don't, well, it may be true. There are a few that are interested, but it isn't like, you know, like in my day, you know, the church was still very much a part of our life because we didn't have, like I'm saying, the distractions that the youth have today.
Right.
Youth have so many other things. There's so many distractions, so much else going on, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's
television has changed our culture. Tonight, the single most contributing factor in just, you know, changing the way that we live. So, you know, I don't think today you care as much about our culture.
And the community is more centered. What about your children? You said you haven't been to Lebanon. Do you hope someday to go? Do you hope to take the children to Lebanon?
Well, I don't think so anymore. I mean, because of everything that's happened. At one point in time, I dreamt of going to see that. Because I could picture, like, things that my dad would tell me about the village and, you know, how he went from one village to the other, about the hills, about, you know, to talk about his horse. Yeah, a white horse. And, you know, I always had the dream one day I could go and stand, you know, on ground that I knew my dad was going to be a Christian some years ago. I think that we've gone on. Unless Lebanon becomes the Lebanon that it was before 1973, I don't think I have any time for that.
Is there anything else you'd like to ask any of this? Anything you want to cover that I haven't hit on?
Oh, no, there probably would be. I mean, a lot of things. I mean, I could probably talk for another 2 days. No, there are all sorts of stories. There's no one, let's say, that's really